We hope you'll stay tuned for a Juno Afternoon. We'll get an update from Robert Barr on library activities, and we'll hear the second episode of the Midnight Oil podcast from Alaska's Energy Desk about the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and how it shaped the state. Katrina Pearson will be here to talk about artist John Van Zyl, who's having an art opening Tuesday night at Kale's. That, Bird Note, Writer's Almanac, music, and more at 4 o'clock. At 3 o'clock and 4 o'clock on KRNN. Taking a look at the weather, it is lovely today. It is currently 65 degrees. Tomorrow, a chance of rain. Thursday, partly cloudy. Friday and Saturday, beautiful.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Indian Health Service will permanently close the Sioux Sand Hospital's emergency room and inpatient services in Rapid City, South Dakota by 2018. Lee Strubinger has more.
IHS's emergency room temporarily closed in September last year. Those seeking emergency room care were referred to the nearby Rapid City Regional Hospital, but it never reopened. IHS officials say they've been focusing Sioux Sand resources on urgent care and outpatient services by shifting ER and inpatient care staff to those clinics. Michael Tote is the chief medical officer with IHS.
And a number of factors led to this decision, including the age of the Sioux Sand facility, which is nearly 80 years old, and the close proximity to the Rapid City Regional Hospital. Since then, by focusing on urgent care and outpatient services and redeploying emergency and inpatient resources to these services, the IHS has determined that its patients are better served with an urgent and outpatient care clinic.
Tote says those seeking inpatient care will get referred to other hospitals. Tote says inpatient services were underutilized. Before the emergency room closure, IHS officials say about 40 patients per day were seen in the ER. Officials say they're planning for new construction at the Sioux Sand facility. For National Native News, I'm Lee Strupinger in Rapid City, South Dakota.
The Oregon County Fair acts plans to display a story poll, but as KLCC's Brian Bull reports, its fate is still being decided.
George Braddock is with the Ritz Sauna and Showers, which had coordinated the story poll project for 5 years. He says the poll is being kept in a warehouse while Ritz staff deliberate.
It's interesting, a lot of people have said that story poll has been imbibed with a lot of spirit, and that in many ways it's going to determine where it ends up.
Mounting criticism erupted months ahead of this year's Oregon Country Fair from Native Americans and their supporters. David Lewis, a cultural anthropologist with the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde, questioned the Haida-style poll's purpose.
Because there was no Haida people involved, they hadn't really gotten an approval from the Haida tribe that it was not really a Haida poll, so that it was cultural appropriation.
Certainly, we apologize for any hurt that has taken place as a result of anything that we've done at Sauna.
Braddock says they worried about boycotts or protests at the Oregon Country Fair this year, but instead they fielded 500 comments from visitors about making the facility more accommodating and comfortable for all visitors. And they remain open to working with an area tribe should they pursue a project similar to the story poll again. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
A Yupik village in Alaska designed its own substance use recovery program this summer. As Avery Lill reports, the wellness camp focused on teaching subsistence skills as part of rehabilitation.
The mood was relaxed at the late July graduation ceremony at Equok Lodge. Three men stood to receive certificates of completion. The graduates, all Alaska Natives, stayed a month learning to depend on subsistence rather than substances like narcotics and alcohol. Equok Natives Limited hired 210 Recovery Services to run the camp. They're an Anchorage company that specializes in substance use disorder rehabilitation. Subsistence was a new component of the program that ENL designed. The Equok community volunteered to teach traditional activities like setting nets to catch salmon and curing them in smokehouses for winter. Jimmy Hurley Sr. is the president of the Village Corporation's board.
Everybody used to put up fish. That should be part of every recovery, bringing culture into it. Culture is really strong. We've lost so much of it.
For two of the three men who graduated, this was their first time putting up fish.
It's fun, picking berries, fishing. It was nice labor. I'm slowly getting used to being clean and sober and looking forward to keeping it that way.
That's a 22-year-old participant who grew up between Equok, the surrounding villages, and Anchorage. The graduates have now returned home, hopefully to continue their journeys with sobriety. I'm Avery Lill in Equok, Alaska.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
And by Humboldt State University, we know what it means to be rooted in community. You can get your Master's of Social Work and amplify your voice without having to leave it. The part-time online program accepts applications between August 1st and 31st. More at humboldt.edu/socialwork. Support by BNSF Railway, moving our economy for over 165 years. Our vision is to operate injury and accident-free with safety programs, training, and technology. More at bnsf.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And welcome to a Juneau Afternoon. I am Lori Scandling. I'm this afternoon's volunteer host, and with me, of course, is our producer, Jeff Brown. Thanks, Jeff, as usual. I'd like to welcome our first guest today, Robert Barr. He is and has been the director of the Capital City Libraries system, but primarily the Juneau Libraries.
That's right.
For the last 4 years. Glad to have you here, Robert.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we were already having an interesting conversation before we went on the air about a variety of databases that can be really helpful as we look ahead to school starting. School starts August 16th. Let's start with that. I know there's always something happening at the library. That's a given. But let's talk about these databases and how students and with their caregivers might interact with these databases.
Yeah, I love talking about our databases. So they're a really a fantastic resource to the community, in particular some ones that we have for kids for the school year starting up. There's one that we have called Live Homework Help. And so Live Homework Help is a resource that you can connect to through your computer, or you have to have an internet connection. And if you don't, you can come to the library and use our internet connection. And basically what it does is you log in and you tell this database, hey, I'm in eighth grade and I need help with world
algebra.
History or algebra, or hey, I'm in high school now and my parents can't really understand this geometry stuff, these theorems, I need some help with that. And the database says, okay, I've got tutors online that have this skill set, right? And then it connects the student with a tutor, and these tutors are vetted, and they go through a background check process, so it's all good on that side of things. And then you get connected with them, and it's kind of like this virtual environment where you have a chalkboard and you type out your question and you kind of go back and forth, and the tutor helps you understand the concepts, and it's a great way to work through some homework dilemmas and problems as you have them.
So it's not a telephone conversation, it's exchanging messages back and forth. You mentioned a virtual chalkboard.
That's right.
So you're typing out what your problems are?
That's right. You're typing. You can draw with your mouse. There's kind of like an area for that in the interface.
So you can write out the equation or whatever you're stuck on.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. What if you don't know what you're stuck on? Sometimes that...
it'll kind of guide you. So, you know, if you're working on a particular class, you know, it's going to ask you for your grade level and it'll ask for some information about your homework assignment. So it'll kind of guide you into getting you connected with the right person who has those skills that'll be able to help you.
And is it free?
It is. Yeah. You have to have a library card, but those are free too. So,
that's right. And there are data that show that youth who have library cards are more likely to graduate high school, which of course carries with it a whole lot of other benefits to individuals as well as to the larger society.
That's right. Yeah.
What is the youngest age someone could be to seek help through the homework service?
It's K through college. So university students and little kids. It's the full gamut. And it runs basically from when school gets out to, I think we go all the way to midnight at night. So there's a wide range of hours available to kids.
And would they get to the portal through junolibraries.org or juno.org/libraries,
that
go in through
one.
That main site, okay.
Yeah.
And then is there an obvious drop-down or link?
Yeah, if you go to research, that'll get you there. Or if you just, even if you just Google Juneau Library Live Homework Help, that would take you there too.
Bring you right there.
Yeah, and we will, as soon as school starts up, we feature certain databases on the homepage of juneau.org/library, and when school starts up, that'll
right
be
there.
That'll be what we feature.
What else have you got in the databases?
So when I'm thinking about like students and kids and in high school and getting back into like government class, one of my favorite databases that we offer is called Points of View Reference Center. And this is a database that looks at some really controversial social and political issues, and it allows you to kind of dive deep down into those issues. So like we all have our political persuasions and our opinions on social issues. And this database lets you, it offers an overview of any given controversial issue, and there's hundreds of them in here. So I'm talking about pretty divisive things here, like police brutality, for instance, abortion, the Middle East peace crisis, like some pretty serious stuff. And so it offers an overview essay on that issue, any given issue, and then it offers kind of a point and a counterpoint to let you kind of get a holistic understanding of the different perspectives around that topic. And it is great for a variety of things, but from a school perspective, it's great for those government classes where you kind of have to think about, okay, what are my sources on this? You know, am I thinking about a source for this issue that is biased? And if it is biased, how is it biased? So that's a great one, Points of View Reference Center.
Important skills to have that are very transferable, way beyond school.
Oh yeah.
Just from evaluating the day's news to mm-hmm. understanding what your next job might be about and how that's framed. Name that database one more time.
Points of View.
Points of View.
Yeah.
And I assume, again, go in through the library portal.
Yeah. And for that one, you will need to click on Research and kind of go find it. It's alphabetical order. You know, that one's interesting. And, in our society today, it seems that we are pretty easily polarized and divided. You know,
easy to put a stake in the ground, isn't it?
It sure is. And so this is one that really kind of helps you understand why you believe what you believe, and probably of equal or maybe more importance, helps you understand what the other side believes. I think it was Thomas Jefferson that said, I never considered a difference of opinion in politics and religion or in philosophy as a cause for withdrawing from a friend. And that's something that we kind of miss out on nowadays, right? Like it's very easy to, as you said, put a stake in the ground and just kind of discount mm-hmm. The opinions that don't align with ours.
And yet nothing really is black and white.
I mean,
those levels of complexity are there, are probably in any issue.
Yeah.
Getting a library card, does one have to go physically into a library, and can it be any library, or is that something that you can secure online? I'm old enough that, you know, you went and applied for a card.
Yeah. You do still have to come. You have to come to the library.
Could you go to a school library?
You can't go to a school library, but you can go to any other library in town. So mm-hmm. the university library or the state library or the public libraries, we're all on the same system. We have started a pilot program at Thunder Mountain where all incoming freshmen are automatically given a card. And we're looking to expand that, but it's a lot of work. So we're working on it. And if you we're also on the same system as a lot of other libraries throughout the state. So the Anchorage Public Library, the Fairbanks, University of Fairbanks, University of Alaska, lots of libraries in Southeast and through the Matsu Valley are all on the same system.
I noticed that when I look for a book, it will say one in Eagle River, and it's good to know that we are networking because we're a small state, of course.
We are.
Not every library can carry everything. So in thinking about library cards, is this something the administration of which could be assisted by volunteers, say, at the beginning of the year to help fresh people, secure life? Could you use some help with that?
Maybe. There are some privacy and confidentiality implications
there. Because they're minors, sure.
Yeah, and there's actually, because they're minors and because there's actually, believe it or not, an Alaska state statute that ensures the confidentiality of library records. So I can't just go out and tell anyone else what you read.
Well, sure, because it's a freedom of speech issue,
it
I
is.
Would guess, meaning what you choose to read is a form of intellectual expression. I would imagine mm-hmm. that should be private.
Yep.
If volunteers are interested in helping at any of the libraries, what might they be asked to do, and how would they be hooked into the system to do that?
Yeah, so it largely depends on volunteer interests. We can always use volunteers to help us with like reshelving books and shelf reading to make sure our collection is accurate on the shelves. Every now and then we have volunteers that have a specific programmatic interest. So right now, for instance, we have a great volunteer who is doing a monthly program on Japanese culture. And she has one coming up, actually, one of the ones I was going to mention, on August 12th at 2 p.m. at the Douglas Library, where she's going to be teaching kids how to make sushi. So if you have a child that would enjoy learning how to make sushi.
It's hands-on,
yeah,
and you get to eat it.
Yeah, that's one where we require registration, so you would want to give us a call on that one. Most of our programs we don't. But that's a good example. You know, if you have a specific programmatic interest, often we'll work with you. Our Think Like a Computer class is run by a volunteer. A computer program, his name is Shay, he works for the state of Alaska as a computer programmer, and he approached us a while back about wanting to teach kids how to code, and we were like, hey, that's great, we want to support you in that, so we'll work with you and develop this program to teach kids how to code, and so we do that. I'd say those are kind of the two areas, programmatic interests, and then kind of those everyday tasks of getting items back on the shelves and shelf reading. Also at the city museum uses a lot of volunteers. And particularly volunteers that have a great understanding of Juneau's history.
Mm-hmm.
Retired folks typically. Yeah.
What else is coming up? Gosh, with school about to start, do you have some programs that are occurring prior to school starting?
Mm-hmm, we do.
Give us a rundown.
So we've got our final youth skills workshop coming up on August 9th in the Valley at 5 p.m. And this one is all about, so let me step back a little bit. So we pay a lot of attention, I think most of us pay a fair amount of attention to our physical health, right? Like getting a lot of exercise and making sure we're eating right, and that's all important. And this youth skills workshop says, okay, that's great. We also want to make sure that we're focusing on our mental health and getting ready for that. So this workshop is taught by a Coast Guard professional counselor who's going to be talking with kids going back into school. We're thinking like middle school, high school age here. And it focuses on like resiliency and remembering, you know, those skills that go into helping us focus, and on some mindfulness behaviors and activities and meditation and breathing, and those kinds of things to help us kind of get back into the swing of school and learning and education.
And we know that the youth brain is not hardwired yet.
No.
And so decision making can be a little scrambled sometime, and the ability to manage stress and prioritize. I certainly saw that working with young men and women who came in as freshmen, just getting their work in on time and staying organized. And school's pretty regimented. It does require some organization. When is that skills workshop again?
That is on August 9th.
Okay.
In the Valley. At 5
o'clock.
p.m.
And does that require pre-registration as well, Robert?
Not. No, that one you just show up for.
Drop in August 9th, 5 o'clock. And it's free?
It is.
Great.
Yep.
What else is on tap?
So we have the Day of Play coming up. And so we, both the City Museum and the Douglas Library are participating in the Day of Play. And there are lots of parks and rec activities happening on that day, too. And so that is Saturday, August 19th, basically all day. The museum part of that is from 10:30 to noon, and so it's free admission.
Wow.
Between 10:30 and noon. You can check out the new fishing exhibit, see if you can tell the difference between a sockeye and a coho. There's going to be a scavenger hunt, lots of hands-on activities. And then at the Douglas Library, we're going to be, that's from 1:30 to 4:30 on that day, again, Saturday, August 19th, and we're going to be talking all about space science, so solar eclipses, Jupiter, the moon. It's all through the NASA at my library program.
So, of course, Cassini is preparing to dive into Saturn for its final death dive
the
very early September. So it's quite timely that Saturn and Jupiter would be the topics on Day of Play. And you said that's August 19th. And you mentioned that the admission to the City Museum will be free. I assume the entire program is free then also?
Yes, from 10:30 to noon.
What else would you like folks to know today?
Well, we are on a story time and toddler time break. So if you are a story time and toddler time attendee, we have in getting ready for school. We're taking a break in August. We still have story time and toddler time through the rest of this week, but then we'll be on break through August 25th. Although, our Spanish story time continues.
Oh, wonderful.
So we do a Spanish story time on Monday nights in the Valley at 5:30. And if you are a Spanish speaker or if you are learning Spanish, this would be a great one for you. Every Monday night.
5:30, LA Library.
Yep.
And before we went on the air, you mentioned that you have an opening at the library.
We do.
I was smiling because it sounded like fun.
Yeah.
Why don't you share that?
Yeah, I will. Thank you for reminding me. So we are going to be posting a job announcement either today or tomorrow, hiring for an outreach assistant. So this is a 30-hour-a-week part-time position that works about half the time providing direct public service to the public at our desks, and then the other half of the time doing outreach programming. And so when I say outreach programming, I mean we do a variety of programming where we go out into the community, specifically to subsets of the community that can't get to the library, so like senior centers and the Johnson Youth Center in specific.
Are you carrying books to them? I don't mean to be naive, but I'm thinking about the bookmobile of my childhood.
Yeah,
we lived in a kind of a rural area, so you would bring books
and
other types of programs?
Yep, we would bring books. We would have book discussions. We would teach them, train them about databases, how to use our online resources, because they certainly can most of the time access those, and do other programming. Yeah.
Sounds fun. We're chatting with Robert Barr. He is the director of Juneau Public Libraries, and there is always something happening at the library. And if you'd like to know more, just Google Juneau Public Libraries and see the various programs that are coming up, all free. A couple require pre-registration, as well as the cool databases that are available to learn more about this world. Thanks for joining us, Robert.
Thanks for having me.
Join me, Kate, for emerging artists and the latest from the greats, every Tuesday on Tideline, 5 to 7 on 102.7 KRNN. You'll hear a mix of music that's the perfect way to start your evening. Tuesday Tidelines with Kate, 5 to 7 on KRNN, 102.7 FM. This summer, Alaska's Energy Desk is taking a deep dive into the history of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, looking at how it shaped our state. We're telling that story in an 8-episode podcast. Today, we're presenting episode 2 on the radio. No download required. It was produced by Energy Desk reporters Rachel Waldholz and Rasha McChesney. Here's Rachel to start things off.
Say you turned on the TV one evening in the fall of 1969. And flipped over to the brand new show, 60 Minutes. You might have been confronted by a striking young man in a turtleneck, making a calm demand.
After these hundreds of years, you know, of battling with the Indian and taking his land and giving him a piddling amount of money, that we think that it's time that the Congress and the American people would please give us a fair deal on our land.
His name is Willie Hensley, and he was 28 years old. He's Alaska Native, Inupiaq, and he was part of a movement demanding the country recognize indigenous rights to vast stretches of the 49th state. Just 2 years later, that plea for land rights would bring something completely new into the world. Because while other parts of the country have Indian reservations, Alaska got private, for-profit corporations. The story of how that happened starts with an epic civil rights battle. And it goes all the way to the White House. And like everything in Alaska, this story is all tangled up with oil. Alaska is an oil state, but it wasn't always, and it almost wasn't. Hello and welcome to Midnight Oil. I'm Rachel Waldholz.
And I'm Rasha McChesney. This is the story of how Alaska became an oil state that asks if we'll always be an oil state. On today's episode, how the discovery of oil helped bring about one of the largest settlements with indigenous people in U.S. history.
And not just the largest settlement, a totally new way of doing things. Depending how you look at it, it's one of the great civil rights victories of the last 50 years.
Or a massive sellout to global capitalism.
Or both.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. AYOGA is celebrating 40 years of Alaska's grit and determination that made Prudhoe Bay and the Trans-Alaska Pipeline possible. Find more history at OurAKSpirit.com. With additional support from NPR Story Lab.
To begin, let's back up to 1959, when Alaska became a state.
Alaska will officially become the nation's 49th state, and by far the largest, more than twice as big as Texas.
Yeah, that's right. More than twice as big as Texas. But most of that land was controlled by the federal government. And the new state needed a way to support itself, to pay for things like roads and schools. So the Fed said, okay, pick out 100 million acres. That's about a quarter of the state. And we'll hand it over to you. Call it a birthday present from Uncle Sam. You can use that land to build your economy. Everyone knew there was good stuff out there. Minerals, timber, and probably oil. There was just one problem. That land was spoken for. Alaska Native people already lived in the region. And as far as they were concerned, it wasn't the federal government's land to give away. It was their land.
I knew that we had to stop it.
Willie Hensley was one of the first to recognize the danger.
Because if we didn't stop it, the land was actually going to be gone forever. We were never going to get it back.
These days, Hensley is a tech-savvy 76-year-old with the texting habits of a millennial. Think GIFs and lots of emoticons. But he was born in a very different Alaska. He grew up near Kotzebue, just above the Arctic Circle. And when he was a kid, his family still lived in the old way, often in sod houses, moving up and down the river, hunting and fishing.
And we had literally no furniture. We had not a bed, not a chair, and we slept on the ground, on willows. That's how I grew up.
After boarding school in the lower 48 and college in D.C., Hensley ended up in grad school in Fairbanks. He decided to research what rights Alaska Native people had to land in the state. And this was becoming a big deal all over Alaska. It was 1966, and the state was going out and selecting its land, that 100 million acre birthday present. And some of that land was near Alaska Native villages.
Meanwhile, Hensley was having an epiphany. Unlike in the lower 48, most Alaska Native people had never been forced off their land. And that left a basic legal right, as Hensley explained to an audience recently.
When I did that research, I said, we own it all, because any lands that we claim, right?
Hensley realized they had one window, and it was about to close. If the state got its land, Alaska Natives would lose the right to claim theirs. He decided he had to get the word out, and quickly. But this was Alaska in 1966. Most villages had maybe one telephone. So how do you organize a social movement with nothing? Well, this revolution was conducted by post office.
I borrowed $10 to buy stamps to send a 4-page letter, which I have a copy of in my bag here, to all of our villages.
And those letters were tacked up on post office bulletin boards or the local store in villages across northwest Alaska.
Hensley's proposal? That they band together and file a claim to all of their land. And not just the land beneath their homes. No, the whole landscape. The goal wasn't just to hold on to some land. The goal was to preserve a way of life. How did you determine which part of it was yours?
Well, I just took a big black pen and a cheap little map, and I just made a claim on all the territory that drained into Kotzebue Sound.
With that black pen, Hensley and his region of about 5,000 people laid claim to 30 million acres, nearly a tenth of the state. And they weren't the only ones. All over the state, Alaska Native people in different regions were starting to file claims. The organization representing residents of the North Slope filed for 58 million acres. That's an area larger than Utah. But nothing was happening. Those claims landed in front of federal officials. Most of them seemed to have no interest in dealing with it. The state was also ignoring the claims. In Anchorage, Emil Nadi decided it was time to try something different. Nadi is Athabaskan from the village of Kayakuk. Back then, he was in his 30s, a Navy vet, an engineer, getting turned down for jobs, he says, when people realized he was Alaska Native. Even now, 40 years later, he radiates a quiet anger when he talks about the past.
It was do or die. It was last chance to have something for the original people of the state.
It was clear that as long as Alaska Native people remained divided, they could be ignored by the powers that be. So Nadi said, let's speak with one voice and see if they can ignore us then.
And this had never happened before. In the summer of 1966, Nadi wrote a letter. He invited about a dozen activists from across the state to a meeting in Anchorage. And that letter went viral. 1966 viral.
And so 300 people showed up at the meeting.
Were you surprised? Were you expecting that many people?
I had no idea.
They met in a room above a fur shop on 4th Avenue in downtown Anchorage. The building wasn't finished yet. Nani says there was a pile of construction material in one corner, and there weren't enough chairs. People sat on the ground.
And this was the meeting that laid the groundwork for the statewide group, the Alaska Federation of Natives. It became the face of the fight for land claims. Delegates were told, go back to your home regions and file for all of your lands. Altogether, Nadi says they probably laid claim to 110% of Alaska.
Yeah, of course, newspapers made a big thing about it. Natives claim more than Alaska.
Back in Washington, D.C., a lot of those filings were landing on the desk and the conscience of one man. Stuart Udall was Secretary of the Interior, responsible for most federal and Indian land in the U.S. Originally from Arizona, he was sympathetic to Native American rights in the West, and he watched the mess unfolding in Alaska and said, enough. The state would not get one more acre of federal land until Congress acted to settle the issue. It became known as the land freeze. And that land freeze was key, because while it was in place, nobody could do anything in Alaska. Suddenly, land rights weren't an Alaska Native problem. They were everybody's problem. The state couldn't choose land to build airports or roads. It couldn't sell new leases for oil exploration. Hensley says with the land freeze, they were essentially going after the economic jugular of what was a very young and still a very poor state.
We didn't have any industry to speak of. We had a small amount of production from oil from the Kenai Peninsula. And there was not enough revenue to fund Alaska.
And then here you come and put a halt to development.
Exactly.
What was the reaction?
Well, they went
Yep. The land freeze enraged many state leaders. There were nasty editorials and death threats.
Meanwhile, the Alaska Federation of Natives waged a public campaign all over the country. They convinced major unions to endorse their cause and the National Council of Churches. Hensley went on Good Morning America and, of course, on 60 Minutes, where he framed it in part as a way to make amends for dark chapters in U.S. history.
You know, and I know, what the history of the United States has been when it comes to the American Indian. The movement west, you know, initially friends, you know, but later on the pressure of settlement. When the Indian wouldn't give, then that's when you had the battles. And you herded them on the reservations. They were a defeated people.
That segment put their cause in front of millions of American viewers. But there was no money. In those first years, Nadi ran the Alaska Federation of Natives on a shoestring. Passing the hat to pay for plane tickets to lobby Congress, he fell behind on his house and car payments. It was all-consuming. And the campaign might have dragged on for many more years. But then, a turning point.
Oil. Billions upon billions of barrels of oil lie under the frozen Arctic in Alaska.
In 1968, companies discovered Prudhoe Bay, at the time the largest oil field in North America, eventually estimated at 25 billion barrels. And this changed everything.
Just like that, Alaska's land freeze was an oil industry problem. To get that oil to buyers, companies would need to build a pipeline clear across the state, 800 miles from the North Slope down to the port of Valdez. And to do that, they needed to know who owned all that land. And that gave Willie Hensley and Emil Nadi and the rest 25 billion barrels of leverage. By 1970, the political stars had aligned, bringing together an unlikely coalition of liberal lawmakers in Congress, the oil industry, and Alaska's own representatives. They were moved by a complicated mix of genuine moral conviction and cold-eyed pragmatism. But it was really the oil industry that pushed the issue over the finish line. Executives had come to believe they could never get their pipeline built without a settlement. Oil lit a fire under Congress. It made the issue urgent, and it meant there was suddenly more than enough wealth to go around. Then, in the final stretch, an unlikely ally came aboard. Richard Nixon.
Yeah, that Richard Nixon. Best known for Watergate. But in Alaska?
I mean, to us, he's a hero.
That's Willie Hensley.
Because he is the one that created self-determination among the tribes,
And he got behind the land claim settlement and delivered. Without him, we wouldn't have had it.
In late 1971, the final deal emerged. It granted more than 40 million acres to Alaska Native people. On top of that, it would pay out nearly $1 billion for giving up the rest of the land. It was perhaps the largest land settlement with indigenous people in U.S. history.
But in Alaska, it was met with mixed emotions. 40 million acres is a lot, more than 10% of the state. It's more land than the entire state of Florida. But in accepting it, Alaska Native people would be formally renouncing their claim to the whole rest of the state, land that they still saw as their own. For some, the loss outweighed the gain. But Nadia and Hensley supported the deal. On December 18, 1971, President Richard Nixon signed the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, or ANCSA. And just like that, it was done. They'd won.
But here's the thing. When Congress agreed to hand over all that land and all that money, they didn't create Indian reservations like in the lower 48. Instead, they created private, for-profit corporations, and Alaska Native people became shareholders. And this is a total break from how things were done in the past. It's like nowhere else in the U.S., actually, like nowhere else in the world at the time. Willie Hensley says he's not even sure where the idea came from.
I don't recall ever us having a serious discussion about the corporate notion. Can you imagine that?
No. Actually, I can't.
Hensley says they just wanted the land. They didn't care about the vehicle. But looking back, there were some good reasons for the corporate structure. First of all, there was real resistance to the idea of creating more reservations. A lot of Congress members were familiar with the reservations in their home states, and they didn't like the outcomes. Also, to get a deal, the state of Alaska had to be on board. And it probably would have been impossible to get the state to agree to 200 separate reservations, essentially sovereign states within its borders.
But above all, people wanted a system that let them control their own destiny, independent of either the state or federal government.
And so suddenly, the young men and women of the Alaska Federation of Natives went from civil rights activists to business people.
There's lots of stories about individuals who all of a sudden started carrying around briefcases. That was not our world, right? And sometimes all they'd say, they'd have smoked salmon in there and maybe a sandwich, you know?
Hensley laughs now, but the pressure was intense. Alaska's remote villages had no electricity, no running water, no jobs. And yet, collectively, people were told, they were rich. They expected the new corporate leaders to turn the settlement into concrete benefits. It was a steep learning curve. In the first two decades, the regional corporations lost 80% of their original endowments. There were ill-advised investments, bankruptcy filings, so many lawsuits.
Nearly 50 years later, Alaska Native corporations are a major feature of the state's economic life.
And the corporate system has avoided a lot of the problems of the reservation system. But it faces a whole slew of separate problems. You know, the kind of problems that face corporations.
Like, how much should you pay your CEOs? And how do you make sure the organization is transparent? How do you avoid concentrating wealth and power? And how do you balance exploring for oil or mining with a mission to take care of the land? Plus, the corporations are expected to do more than just make money. They're supposed to sustain their cultures. And how do you do that?
Those are the questions a new generation is grappling with. Last October, 50 years to the month after that first meeting over the fur shop, Emil Nadi looked out at a much bigger crowd, this time gathered in Fairbanks.
Distinguished Alaskans, all of you, it's my pleasure to be here today. It's hard to believe that 50 years have gone by since we had the first meeting.
These days, the Alaska Federation of Natives draws thousands of people. The governor showed up. Willie Hensley spoke. Nadi received a standing ovation. And he was followed at the mic by a younger leader. Megan Alvana Stimpfel is the same age Nadi was back in 1966, when he wrote his letter calling people together from across the state. And she issued her own call to action for a new generation to step up and make sure the corporations reflect their values.
There's a risk of losing our identity. As wealth creation continues across our state, we must ensure we don't lose who we are, Native people. For if we lose who we are, there is nothing that will separate us from corporate America.
And she urged the audience to take on the unfinished business of the Settlement Act. like the fact that those born after 1971 aren't automatically included in the corporations. That can leave them with no say in the biggest decisions facing their communities. But, she says, corporations have given Alaska Native people economic power. And with that comes political power, the power to shape their own destiny.
We're the Alaska Native community and we're protectors of this land. We always have been. And we're still here. We cannot forget who we are and the collective power that we have together. In my mind, I'm not a corporate Native. I'm not a tribal Native. I'm an Unipiaq. Ogivumilvurunga. I'm a King Islander.
And she issued a call back to the original purpose of the land claims movement. Not to build corporations, not to bring in money, but to hang on to the land, and with it, an identity. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Midnight Oil. Our story was edited by Annie Feit and Jennifer Pemberton and mixed by Dave Waldron. James Glaves composed our theme music.
Thanks to the Alaska Federation of Natives for audio from their 1971 and 2016 meetings.
Next time on Midnight Oil, how the discovery of oil on Alaska's North Slope helped shape the environmental movement as we know it. I'm Rachel Waldholt.
And I'm Rasha McChesney.
To make sure you don't miss a single episode, subscribe to Midnight Oil wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks for staying with us on a Juno afternoon. I'm this afternoon's volunteer, Lori Scandling, and that was part two of the eight-part series, Midnight Oil. We will carry two segments a week on Monday and Tuesday. So please stay tuned and listen to that next week as well. My next guest is Katrina Wolford, and she's here to talk about the very well-known artist John Van Zyl, who is having an art opening this evening at Kales. Welcome, Katrina.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me.
I have to say, when I looked at the name John Van Zyl, I immediately could picture his work in my head. I think it's so distinct. How would you describe his work?
You know, he is one of Alaska's most well-known artists, and I think his popularity comes from his ability to really sort of evoke that Alaskan spirit through scenes and experience, you know, that we all share, like community and cabins and hunting and fishing. And John is also very well known for his work that depicts mushing. And he's been the official Iditarod artist for over 30 years.
He did run the Iditarod a couple of times. He's in the Iditarod Hall of Fame. And I'm looking at the book in front of us here. And, of course, he is depicting sled dogs.
Yes.
Talk about this book. I believe you published it. Is that correct?
I did not. I'm here wearing a couple of hats, though. I'm here and John is not, because John and his wife Jonna are right now at Annie Kale's downtown. And John, they're signing prints. He has prints there. He has the new Iditarod poster. He has two new books. These are by Epicenter Press. I've published a 2018 calendar for John, and that is also there, and he's signing. So he's there from 3 to 6. So that's why I'm here talking about him.
Describe the book that is here. What is its focus?
This particular book is, it's a biography, really, you know, and it's written by him. It's a wonderful sort of tiny exhibit about his life and his upbringing and his inspiration and all of the things that he's experienced.
And how long has he been in Alaska? Do you know how long he's been in Alaska? I don't think he was born here.
He wasn't, but decades. I mean, 1979, I think, was when he became the official Iditarod artist. So.
There are some other activities while John Van Zyl is in town. Can you talk about those as well, please?
Sure. So tonight is, or now, is Annie Kales, and then tomorrow he's going to be signing books and calendars at the store at the APK, which is the store in the State Museum building.
Now, I know he has published, I think it's over 300 various prints.
Mm-hmm.
Are those from amongst which you selected then the 2018 calendar? Or how did you ever make those choices? He has such a broad repertoire.
You know, what was sort of wonderful about publishing the calendar for him was that he created new original work. It was just fantastic, yeah. Yeah, the calendar, all new original pieces with text, and it's really lovely.
And what will be at Annie Kales? How many different items will be offered? And do you know if they are all new as well, or if he is reprising some of his previous work? Because he has quite the catalog.
He does. I think mostly it will be prints, and then books and calendars.
And what price range are we talking? Do you know? The calendar
and the book pricing. I think there's a range in pricing when it comes to prints, and that also, you know, whether they are flat or framed, you know, that's going to affect the price.
But he is there right now to sign them.
He and his wife, Jonna, are there right now.
Well, I would guess the calendars run, what, maybe $20 or something?
Oh, yeah, $12.
Oh, my gosh. So really affordable as gifts for family members at Christmas or visitors, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So about how many, I'm thinking about the pantheon of Alaska artists
mm-hmm.
who are so recognizable and so publishable, whether it's Fred Makatons or our own Riemann Yoz,
sure.
Or others. That's a pretty small cadre, I would guess.
I think so. I would say maybe a dozen. I mean, when people really come to mind, you know, Sidney Lawrence and Ziegler and Birdsall, you know, some of those names that we, you know, when you say their name, you can picture their work.
Yeah. As you said, he evokes Alaska. Does his work capture all seasons, or does he have a focus? I mean, obviously the Iditarod has to be run during the winter.
Right.
Where does most of his work lead us to
sure.
in terms of seasons or settings?
He has, you know, he has beautiful work that represents all seasons. That was sort of a joy in the calendar because each piece was created for the month. And, I mean, obviously his Iditarod work is going to be winter-focused and snow and ice, but he has beautiful imagery of summer and of fishing and fall.
We're talking with Katrina Wilford about John Van Zyl's book, and this one is about his life. And the jacket says it chronicles his diverse life in the autobiographic Alaska's Artist John Van Zyl, My Colorful Life of Art and Adventure, and it shares the adventures of his earliest paintings up to his recent work. And I love this blurb from Dennis Corrington up in Skagway. John Van Zyl is the only artist in Alaska that buys paint in 55-gallon drums. If you're interested in seeing Van Zyl's work, it is on display right now at Kale's, as is the artist who is there to sign. He will also be signing tomorrow. What time, Katrina, at the APK?
Noon to 2 in
noon
the store.
To 2. So he'll mm-hmm. be there. You can meet him. He'll mm-hmm. be there for a couple of hours. And he has a huge catalog of work, and you can see some of that work up close at Kale's today or at the APK bookstore, which Katrina runs and owns. Is that right, Katrina?
That is right.
Tomorrow. How often do we get high-profile artists in Juneau who can sign their work for us and we have a chance to talk with them? It seems like it's not a common occurrence.
It's not. I mean, we have a very rich arts scene. So I think that people should take every opportunity. You know, I think you should go to Kale's and see John and Jonna today and stop by the bookstore tomorrow. We're very lucky.
How frequently does an artist publish this size book? And I call this the backpack size book because it can fit in your backpack. How frequently do Alaska artists publish something that actually is in a book form? I saw a Mark Kelly book recently mm-hmm. at this size. But mm-hmm. how common are those to find?
Are you talking about the size, the actual
mm-hmm.
trim size
and
of
that
the
would,
publication?
That would capture the work of, say, a well-known Alaska person.
Well, I think, you know, historically, art books were much larger, and I think, you know, if a more suitable size lends itself to the work, which it does in John's case, you have something that, you know, you get to bring it to a wider audience because it's more affordable, more accessible. And so there is a little bit of a trend. There are several art books out by Alaska artists in the smaller trim size.
Well, this is lovely, and I hope folks have a chance to see it. Some old Ween Alaska airline posters, as well as art of various kinds of animals in Alaska, of course, sled dogs. So if you'd like to meet John Van Zyl, that's today at Kale's right now. Thanks for joining us, Katrina.
Thank you.
is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 1st of August, 2017. It's the birthday of the first female astronomer, Maria Mitchell, 1818, the island of Nantucket, Massachusetts, daughter of Quaker parents who believed that girls should have the same access to education. Her father was an amateur astronomer, and the girl learned the mathematics of astronomy when she was very young. By the age of 12, she was assisting her father with his astronomical observations. Then she opened and ran her own school for girls, training them in the sciences and math. And October 1st, 1848, she focused her father's telescope on a distant star and suddenly realized she was looking not at a star but at a comet, and she recorded its coordinates, and the comet became known as Miss Mitchell's Comet. In 1865, she was the first woman appointed to the faculty of the newly formed Vassar College for Women. It's the birthday of Herman Melville, 1819, New York City, born to a family of Revolutionary War heroes and merchants who had fallen on hard times. He left school to become a bank clerk, then he tried farming, teaching. He took to sea at the age of 18 as a cabin boy on a merchant ship bound for Liverpool. Came back, tried his fortune in the West. He saw the prairies, he saw the Mississippi headwaters, the Falls of St. Anthony, returned to the East. 1841, he signed up for the whaling ship, the Acushnet, to look for whales in the Pacific. It was an adventure. He jumped ship in the Marquesas. He was held by a band of Polynesians. He escaped from them, jumped that ship, made his way to Hawaii, and then back to the mainland. He was 25 years old, and he wrote about his adventures in Polynesia and about whaling in his first novel, Typee, which was an instant bestseller. Then he wrote another one, O Mu. And then, under the influence of the Transcendentalists and Nathaniel Hawthorne, he wrote his masterpiece, Moby Dick, which got mixed reviews, which disappointed his fans who were looking for another adventure story. And Herman Melville settled into life in New York City as a customs inspector. Here's a poem for today by Robin Sarah, On Closing the Apartment of My Grandparents of Blessed Memory. And then I stood for the last time in that room. The key was in my hand. I held my ground and listened to the quiet that was like a sound, and saw how the long sun of winter afternoon fell slantwise on the floorboards, making bloom the grain in the blonde wood. All that they owned was once contained here, as the window moaned a splinter of wind. I would be going soon, I would be going soon, but first I stood hearing the years turn in that emptied place whose fullness echoed, whose familiar smell of a tranquil life lived simply, clung like a mood or a long-loved melody there, a lingering grace. Then I locked up and rang the janitor's bell. On Closing the Apartment of My Grandparents of Blessed Memory, a poem by Robin Sarah, from Questions About the Stars, published by Brick Books and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity, with a 10-minute fit test to calculate baseline scores and training programs with 50 challenging brain games. Learn more at lumosity.com. And by Magoosh, online test prep for the ACT, SAT, GMAT, GRE, LSAT, and MCAT. Prep smart, go far, and enjoy the ride at magoosh.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
This broadcast is sponsored in part by Ron's Apothecary at the Mendenhall Mall. Serving Juneau since 1978, Ron's Apothecary is providing medication information, nutritional supplements, and homeopathic remedies. More information at ronsapothecary.com.
This is Bird Note. I bet you've heard this sound before, maybe on the soundtrack of a movie. It's a bird voice so distinctive, it's become one of the best-known sounds in nature. This oddly familiar, crazed laughter belongs to the laughing kookaburra of Australia. Its exotic call has been a Hollywood standard for decades, that unseen creature lurking in the depths of the African jungle, or any jungle for that matter, in movies with heroes ranging from Tarzan to Indiana Jones. But in reality, just what kind of birds are kookaburras? They're hefty members of the kingfisher family, found primarily in Australia and New Guinea. The laughing kookaburra, one of four species of kookaburras, stands 18 inches tall and is the largest of all kingfishers. Unlike our familiar waterside kingfishers, kookaburras live in open woodlands and dive for branches to capture snakes, lizards, and mice. The bird's name, which imitates its raucous call, derives from an Australian Aboriginal language, Wiradjuri. It's also earned the name Bushman's Clock, Breakfast Bird, and Alarm Bird for its reliable habit of loudly ringing in the dawn. Listeners support our show. Thank you. I'm Michael Stein.
Thanks for joining us today on a Juno Afternoon. I'm Laurie Scandling, and our producer is Jeff Brown. Tomorrow on a Juno Afternoon, we'll talk with artists Wayne Owen and Vivian Faith Prescott about their show at the Jack this First Friday. It is First Friday this week, by the way. Photographer Toby Harbinuck will be here to highlight his selection as the featured artist for August at the Juno Artist Gallery. And we'll learn about First Friday at the Canvas, along with news about fall classes. That Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, Music, and more on a Juno Afternoon. We're live at 3 on KTOO, repeated at 4 on KRNN, and we're always available on demand online at KTOO. Thanks for joining me today. Taking a quick look at the weather. Lovely afternoon today. It is 65 degrees. Tomorrow, there is a 30% chance of rain, which means there's a 70% chance of no rain. Same on Thursday. Friday, big yellow ball in the sky, and the same for Saturday. So we're getting a slice of summer. Get out and enjoy it. Thank you.